Okay, thank you for the introduction. Thanks for inviting me, Dhammaloka, as well. So here I am, talking about living in the mandala. So this is going to be quite a personal talk, in the sense, it's just going to be like a long reporting in, really, this talk. It's going to be talking about my personal experience. So I'm going to be talking about living in the mandala of the London Buddhist Centre. And in a way, it's been quite, for a number of reasons, it's been quite a hard sort of subject to think about. And one of the reasons why it's been a bit difficult is, I just feel so in it. It's quite hard to describe it in a way. A friend of mine said, it's a bit like asking a fish to describe water. You just kind of think, well, it's just it. I don't quite know what to say about it. So I was helped a little the other day. I just got a glimpse of seeing it through someone else's eyes. A very tiny little incident. I happened to be coming back from a retreat, and I was coming back with a friend of mine, Shraddha Pushpa, who's quite an elderly lady now. We used to live together in a community until recently. Anyway, she's in her 80s. She's very poor of sight and hard of hearing, and she walks with a white stick. We'd been on retreat together, so we're coming back, and I was helping her a little bit coming back. And as I drew near to my house and her house, she lives nearby, we bumped into another friend, Shubha, another order member, and Shubha had her sister with her. They'd been celebrating Shubha's birthday. Anyway, passed them in the street, spent a few words in greeting, and, well, I didn't really think twice about it. You know, that sort of thing happens all the time where I live. And then it was only later that Shubha told me that her sister had been really impressed by this incident, had just been really impressed that they had bumped into sort of, other people from the community, the larger community in the street. It made quite a very positive impression on her. She thought, oh, well, Shubha must be all right. She lives in this mandala, in this community of people who, you know, care about each other and who you can just bump into walking down the street. So it was a nice little glimpse of seeing something perhaps through someone else's eyes that, yeah, as I say, I take for granted myself. So I thought I'd just start by telling you a little bit about how I live and where I live. So how I live now is I live in a Buddhist community, and there's 12 of us live there, 12 women. We occupy two houses, and six of us are order members, six of us are mitras. And there's quite a range in age, so people ranging from their 20s to their 60s. Living in the community. And also, I was struck by this just listening to Ratna Ghosh's talk last night, that there's four sets of people living with their preceptors or prospective preceptors in the house. So amongst us, there's four of us living with people who either have or will ordain us, or people who either we have or will ordain. So I quite like that. I quite like we've got that spectrum at home. And, we meditate together in the morning. Some of us, we're not terribly strict about that. In a way, whoever comes along does. But what we are, like, fairly, I don't know if strict's quite the right word, but fairly hot on is that we do meet together once a week for our community night. We meet loads of other times as well as that. And one of the things I really appreciate about this community situation where I live, which I'll come back to later, is it's been established for nearly 30 years. And I really feel that in the house that I live, that I really feel resting on the shoulders of, like, oh, I don't know how many, I don't know how you'd even begin to count them up, all the women that have lived in that particular building as a Buddhist community for such a long time. And, you know, hearing various stories and kind of knowing that it's been a result of, well, blood, sweat, tears, everything. But, that I'm sort of resting on that. And we live, I mean, there's two houses, then next door there's another house, and next door another house, and they're women's communities as well. So we've got a row of four houses that are women's communities. We share a garden. And nearby there's some men's communities as well. So all together, and they're all very, very nearby the London Buddhist Centre. Somebody mentioned this morning that it's affectionately called the Buddhist Village where I live. So we're all, it's within 3 or 4 minutes of the Buddhist Centre, this little mandala of communities. And also very near the Buddhist Centre itself are a number of Buddhist businesses or Buddhist associated businesses. So next door but one to the Buddhist Centre is a little second-hand bookshop. Up the street a few minutes, there's our new second-hand clothes shop, Llama's Pyjamas. Bookshop's called Jambala. And then a little bit further up, there's our natural health centre, Bodywise. And then over the road, there's the London Buddhist Arts Centre. Back down the road again, there's an evolution shop, which actually is no longer run by a Buddhist team. It was run by a Buddhist team for very many years, actually, up until a few months ago. But it is still there. And next door to the Buddhist Centre is what was, until recently, our restaurant, the Wild Cherry Restaurant, which had been going for 30 years. It's just closed down. I'll be saying a bit more about that later. And those businesses, the whole London Buddhist Centre has been there for almost exactly 30 years, and those businesses have built up gradually around the Buddhist Centre. Jambala, the second-hand bookshop, and the Wild Cherry, they were from the very beginning, those buildings were part of the whole complex of the London Buddhist Centre, which was a rather majestic old fire station, which was... many of you know the story. It was renovated with more blood, sweat and tears 30 years ago. But the other buildings where we house the other businesses, they've been accumulated more gradually. And I think the story of how we've come across them says quite a lot about our relationship with the wider community, with the community of Bethnal Green in East London, where this whole conglomeration is. I don't know what it was like. I wasn't there when the London Buddhist Centre was initially being built, but I imagine, and from little bits of hearsay, that it must have been quite, I don't know what it was like, actually. It must have been quite an oddity for the locals of very working class, very traditional society of East End London to have these Buddhists suddenly coming in, building a Buddhist centre, and I imagine that there was I imagine they were treated with some suspicion or some wondering about, well, who were these people with strange names and doing this meditation and so on. But what I think is interesting is that over the years, relationships have built up between our Buddhist community. Our Buddhist community is definitely, well, more and more integrated in the bigger community. And I think the way we've got our other businesses tell a little story about that. For example, I worked for a long time in the Wild Cherry, and our window cleaner was called Joe. And one day, and Joe also has been the window cleaner, he ran the Working Men's Club up the road. And then one day Joe came in and he said, look, we really need to rent out the top floor of our club. We need to, you know, we can't afford to keep it. Would you like to rent it from us? And in that way, the art centre was born. We also, at the Cherry, our veg man, Paul, he was our veg man for years and years and years, and he also had a little vegetable shop up the road. And then when he came to retire from that vegetable shop, he particularly wanted us to have it. He gave us the sort of first offer on that shop, and that became... first of all, Friends Organic, which has also recently closed down, and now it's Llama's Pyjamas, our gift shop. And then there was a little bakery across the road, and then they were retiring, and they wanted us to have their shop as well. So I thought that was very interesting. There's other stories like that as well, where people in the local community, well, they saw us, as far as I can see, as people who would... will enhance the community, look after their shops, which had been in their families for years, you know, these shops, generations, I imagine. But they kind of thought, well, these Buddhists who at first were treated with suspicion now were kind of worthy people to take on their businesses, and they trusted us that we'd make something of them that would bring something positive into the area. Another sort of on a similar sort of vein of this, how I think we've impacted the local community. Recently, about a year and a half ago, I took part in a door knocking fundraising campaign in our local area of Bethnal Green. We were trying to raise money. We were expanding our Buddhist centre. We were doing a huge project, part of which was to enable us to do more teaching for people with depression, people recovering from addiction, and for carers. And to do this, we wanted to really expand the premises. And we were fundraising like crazy. And then some of us, four or five of us, had the idea that we could just go round the knock doors in the locality and ask them for money. I must mention here Karuna, because all of us who did this had been trained by Karuna on Karuna appeal. So we were quite confident, oh yeah, we can knock these doors and people will give us money. I remember other people in the centre, they were looking at us as if we were crazy, like, you'll never get money like that. But we thought, yes, we will. And we did. But what was very interesting about knocking these doors is, so I'd knock a door and I'd say, oh, I'm from the London Buddhist Centre. Have you heard of us? And they say, oh yeah, we go to your yoga class. Or they say, oh yeah, you know, we always get our bread from your health shop. Or, oh yeah, we always take our stuff to your second-hand shop. And that to me was very, very interesting, how people in the locality, when I said London Buddhist Centre, they saw the whole thing as the London Buddhist Centre. In a way, maybe even more than we did, I was thinking, ourselves, that they weren't distinguishing between, well, this bit of it's where you teach meditation and this bit's where you sell brown rice. They saw the whole thing as the London Buddhist Centre, and they felt positive about it. There wasn't a single negative response. None of us received a negative response when we talked about the centre. We might have had a bit of a neutral response, often very positive response, but there was nothing negative from all those doors that we knocked. And we went quite widely, you know, we spread out. We did it over a period of 6 weeks, an evening, a week each. So we covered quite a big area. And and we got £1,000 in cash from knocking those doors as well, which again, I think that's, well, it's great to have the money, but in a way even better to actually see, well, what, you know, this is what people think of us now. They'll give us £1,000, you know, just because we've asked for it. So I think that's quite interesting how we've affected the locality, maybe more than we even know. I would imagine more than we know. Okay, so I thought I'd say a little bit more about me now. I've written down here that I love work, which I do. I do like being active. I really love the little saying of Khalil Gibran, work is love made visible. I feel that very strongly. I enjoy working, and I do feel, it's an expression of my care. So I love working, and I've worked most of my adult life. So I graduated in physics in 1985, and I've worked nearly all the time since then. But for less than 2 years of that, I've worked for an actual wage. For about 1.5 years, I worked as a science editor, and I got a wage for that. Can't remember how much. And more recently, I did 4 months teaching work and 3 weeks shop work, and I got a wage for both those things. And I, especially after the 3 weeks shop work, even though it was an evolution shop, the experience of working for wages, I remember thinking, I hope I never again have to do that in my whole life. And I'll talk a bit more about that later, what I found that I didn't like about that. But the rest of the time, apart from those bits of work where I've worked for a wage. I've worked in Buddhist teams and been on what you've heard of us called support packages. So I worked for about 10 and a half years in the Wild Cherry restaurant. I've worked about 6 years in the Dublin Evolution shop. I've done a couple of Karuna appeals. I've supported a couple of long retreats. And at the moment, I'm the Mitra convener at the London Buddhist Centre. I've been doing that for about 2.5 years. And I really hope I can carry on like that. I hope I can carry on working in Buddhist teams and supported in that way on support packages. Well, for as long as possible, really. For as long as I'm fit to do something, I hope I can carry on working in that way. So another bit of autobiography. So ever since I was really, really small, I knew that I didn't want to get married and I knew that I didn't want children. I knew that from when I was quite tiny. Nobody believed me. I used to say it, you know, as a child. They'd say, oh, you know, you grow out of it. Wait till you grow up. You'll want to get married. You'll want to have children. But I knew I wouldn't. And the only person who did believe me was my gran. She said that she knew from when I was 5 years old and my younger sister was 4 years old that my sister would have children and I never would. So she believed me, and she was right. I think partly this was coming from quite a large family. I had six brothers and sisters younger than me. So I never wanted that kind of lifestyle of having a family. So when I came across the FWBO when I was about 23, well, the possibility of community living was great. Well, that just really excited me that there was a possibility of. But you see, I didn't really know how I was going to fit in before, you know, and then I came across this community life. And it was great. I remember being so excited. My friend and I went round. We heard there was a vacancy in a community and we went round. So excited to sort of, we thought, oh, I wonder if they'll accept us in their community. And then we went round and had dinner and then we got told, yes, we could move in. And I just remember the thrill of we've been allowed to move into this community. That really suited me to live in women's communities, which I have done more or less most of my life since then. It's interesting because it's not, although I've lived in women's communities all that time, it's not that I haven't had romantic relationships in that time, even quite substantial ones. And it was interesting recently about my current relationship. Somebody was asking me, well, is it really a proper relationship? You know, you don't live together. My partner, he also lives in a Buddhist community, several hours' journey away. So they were saying, you know, is it really proper? You know, you don't have any of that nitty-gritty stuff, like arguments about the washing up and so on. Which, frankly, I'm quite glad not to have in my relationship. And maybe on a more serious note, you know, all the things I imagine those of you that do have that kind of partnership would have, like looking after each other when you're sick and so on. So they were sort of saying, well, it isn't a proper relationship without that. Or they were asking me that. And what I thought was, I certainly don't think that that's essential to have that with my partner. But I do think it's essential to have it somewhere in my life. Somewhere, I think, I would really want to have that intimacy in my life. And that kind of, well, that practice of going beyond myself. I was touched recently in one of the men's communities nearby. One of the young men was very, very ill in the night and woke up my friends, Maitreya Bandhu and Jnanavacha in the night. And, you know, off they went to hospital together and stayed up the whole night together. I'm sure there's loads of stories like that from those of you that live in communities. So I do definitely want that intimacy and that looking out for each other in my life, but I don't necessarily think it has to come through my relationship. Bhante says a very interesting thing. Actually, I don't know where he originally says it. It's quoted in the book that's a compilation of his teachings. He says, the danger of falling into selfishness and preoccupation is greater in a monastic community than it is for lay people with all their family, all their kith and kin to care for, because it's much more difficult to care for others out of a spiritual motivation as opposed to sexual or family interest. So that's interesting, isn't it? I thought those of us that are in discussion groups might want to discuss that tomorrow. That is, yeah, that the danger of falling into selfishness is greater than a monastic community. And my response to that, I mean, not that I exactly live in a monastic community, maybe semi-monastic is the closest term, but my response to that is I do find that a positive challenge, actually. I want to create the bonds with my fellow community members and other friends that are as strong as the ties of my family. And to me, that feels like quite a tall order, because I feel my ties with my family just feel so strong. You know, my sisters, you know, if I hear one of my sisters is struggling or in pain, you know, it just breaks my heart. You know, I want to just help her, you know. And what I want is not for that to become less, but my care for my friends to become as much as that. And, you know, that takes work, really. That takes actually, well, practicing doing it. But yeah, it's a very strong ideal of mine that would be the case, that we'd look after each other as much as look after family, and that those bonds would be as strong. I think of this, if it's not too fanciful, in terms of spiritual rebirth as well. I often think, well, I really want to be reborn into a spiritual community. And if I don't work at creating bonds that are as strong as my family bonds, then that's not going to happen. If I want to be reborn in the spiritual community, which I do, I'll have to work it. I have to put that work in now. And maybe if that's too fanciful, you could think of that rebirth as just happening moment to moment as we create those ties with our spiritual friends, those bonds. So, back to my little autobiographical details. So at that time of my first community, I was working after graduation science. I worked for the Royal Society of London, which was quite a posh job, actually. I didn't really realise that at the time. I kind of thought all jobs were like that. I was a bit naive, but there I was in this very grand building. But quite soon I started helping. I learned that I encountered Buddhism around about that time. And I started helping out in the wild cherry. It was called the Cherry Orchard then, on Saturdays. I just kind of felt I wanted to help. I felt, you know, I think again, often many of us feel this, a gratitude for having learned to meditate. I wanted to help. I was really, really shy. I'm very, very... I had never lived in a city before or anything. I didn't really know my way around. And there I was working with this team of women who were nothing like I expected. I thought they'd be all kind of holy and pure and everything. Then there was this kind of wild bunch of women. But what I remember very, very strongly is how much they drew me out and drew me on. And what I remember even articulating this to myself quite early on, that they saw more potential in me than I saw in myself. And even at that quite young age, I could see that that wasn't happening in my work at the Royal Society, although it was, you know, it was a very, very nice job, the Royal Society work. But that I wasn't being drawn out in that way. So it wasn't very long before I gave up my Royal Society work completely and went to work full-time in the Cherry Orchard. And I think there, actually, my Catholic conditioning had a positive effect there, because the idea of living for what you believe in was quite strongly instilled in me. I didn't really realise that at the time, but looking back, I thought it wasn't that hard a move to make to just... Well, I just ditched my career in one fell swoop. I'd been to university and everything, but I didn't really mind about giving that up. And I thought, oh, well, I did have an uncle who was a priest and an aunt who was a nun. So that was quite instilled in me, that was what people did, you know. The whole idea of vocation. So it was quite easy to do that, although I missed my business card. That was the thing I missed most. And I must confess that when I was working on the counter in the cherry, I did try and use quite big words to show off my vocabulary to the customers so they wouldn't just think I was just a serving girl. So they'd know I'd been to university. but apart from that, it was quite an easy move. So all completely suited me, all this lifestyle. As I say, you know, I didn't really fit in. You know, my friends from school and so on wouldn't have, you know, they were probably, I don't really know what they're doing now, but I imagine most of them are still there where we grew up in this quite small town. And I imagine most of them have families and so on. So I didn't fit in with that. So I don't really know, even on an ordinary social level, what actually would have happened to me if I hadn't met the FWBO. I don't know what would have become of me. I tried to think about this a few years ago. I've got a little practice of every year I try and remember and send a card, a thank you card to Damarati, who taught me to meditate in the first place. And on one of these cards, I decided to write a sort of fantasy life of what I imagined might have happened if he never taught me to meditate and I'd never met the FWBO. And I kind of, how I imagine myself, I mean, you don't really know, do you? But I imagine myself, kind of, maybe I'd worked my way up a bit as a science editor. Maybe I had, you know, gone from being a sub-editor to an editor. But I definitely had myself living on my own in a sort of garret-type flat, kind of drinking red wine in the evenings, trying to write really bad poetry, maybe having the occasional lover, but no one that I was really close to. And just lonely, really. Just lonely and just, unfulfilled. Like knowing there was something, but not quite knowing how to access it. So that's my little fantasy picture of myself if I hadn't met the FWBO. But luckily I did. And spent the next 10 or 11 years in the situation I've just described. And I really liked it on the little blurb that Dhammaloka wrote for this Transform Self and World seminar. He said, in relation to trying to build a new society, people have found themselves full of hope and close to despair. And yes, that was very much what it was like those 10 or 11 years. There was definitely lots of inspiration and hope and lots of times of despair and difficulty. But definitely very, very positive practice overall. In that time, I got ordained. And this whole practice of team-based right livelihood and community living was, I would say, by far the major factor in me becoming ordained. By the time of my ordination, actually the team of us who ran the Wild Cherry lived together in a community together as well. So we created this very intensive situation of living and working together. Quite soon after I got ordained, I decided to move to Dublin. At the time there were no women order members in Dublin, so me and a friend, Padma Vasani, decided, who also lived in London, moved to Dublin. In the event she went first, and I joined her a year later. So this was in my maybe early to mid-30s. I went off to Dublin, and of course, you know, I thought, well, I can bring all this experience, this richness of the LBC, you know, this is great, I can bring all this to Dublin, and the experience of community living and teams. What was very fortunate in Dublin was there was already an evolution shop established. And I mean, that was great. If that hadn't been there, I couldn't have gone. I mean, I think the value of these things, the more I think of them, the more valuable they are. I mean, that's literally true. I couldn't have gone because there would have been no livelihood for me that enabled me to work at the centre. But as it was, there was an evolution shop, so the, you know, it was fantastically beneficial because, well, I could work with women, I could, you know, deepen my own practice, which continued to deepen. I mean, my experience of team-based right livelihood is every now and then I think, oh, I think I've learned everything there is to learn from this now, but there'd always be something else. So deepen my own practice. I could teach at the centre as well. There were very few, there's only two or three of us running the centre, so it was very kind of conducive working there to also being able to teach at the centre. And I was financially supported, again, extremely generously. It meant that I could keep in touch with the order and friends back in the UK because Windhorst paid for me to come over on order weekends three or four times a year to come on retreats and so on. And that was a very important part of me being in Dublin, that I could keep in touch like that. And the shop, it was in the time of it was in that heyday time that Kate Raja described when there was loads of money sloshing around. We made so much money. I think that shop in its whole time made about €500,000 or €1 million to give away euros. I can't remember if it was €500,000 or €1 million, but quite a lot anyway. The one thing about it was, though, that it wasn't, in contrast to the London Buddhist Centre, it wasn't near the centre. And that was... that, for the first time, made me appreciate, get a glimpse of appreciation of, in London, the benefits of having businesses that were physically near the centre. I remember missing that, you know, because you, in a way, well, people from the centre would come from time to time, but it wasn't the same. But anyway, there I was. I worked there and set up a community with others quite soon, and we set it up together. So I went along like that for six more years, and more inspirations, more despairs, even more intense in a way, because it was a much smaller situation. But then a kind of disaster struck in a way, which was a disaster for me personally, which is one night, there was four of us in our little community, and one night we're having community night, and two people said they wanted to leave the community. And suddenly, there was no community. The community folded. Like, from one day having the community, the next day there was no community. The community folded in an instant. And then, a few months after that, we got a letter from the landlords of the shop saying they were doubling the rent. And the shop, in the end, closed down because of that. So that was quite, I found that a hard year. I found myself in a difficult position regarding work. Well, I didn't have any income suddenly. But also it was a bit tricky because even if I had got another job, then that would have meant that I couldn't so easily work at the centre. By this time, I think I was the only Dharmacharini working at the centre. And then if I couldn't work at the centre, what was the point in me being in Dublin? So the whole thing, it was just very, very difficult. And I sort of cobbled together a living, which actually I'll tell you a bit more about in a minute. But I got some money together, enough for a year, and I thought, I'll do this for a year. But I think it's only sustainable for a year. So I left after a year. It was a hard year, and I had this little insight, which sounds like so... kind of silly, it's a kind of truism really, but it struck me with a bit of force. I realised that in order to live in a community, you need other people to want to do it as well. I mean, it sounds so obvious, but I thought I cannot do this out of my own willpower. I mean, it's interesting because some other choices, like living on one's own, for example, is just up to you, but living in a community, by its definition, you need other people to do it. Working in a team with other people, you need other people to do it. And for that year in Dublin, no one wanted to do either of those things apart from me. So that was hard, you know, very, very painful. So what did I do? I left, and I spent a couple of years doing a bit of this and a bit of that. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do next? And I looked around. I knew that I wanted to once again live in community and work in a Buddhist team, at least one of those things. And I looked around. I thought, well, where is that vibrant? And I decided to move back to the London Buddhist Centre. And I felt when I moved back, I felt I appreciated and still do appreciate those things. I mean, about 100 times more. I can't tell you how much more I appreciate them. I just felt such a sense of gratitude, for those things I was saying about our community, for all the people who sustained it over the years, so that it was still there. Because I realised how much I'd taken it for granted before. I realised that before I'd thought of community living or working in a Buddhist business as something I could just choose to do or not, as the whim took me. And my experience in Dublin was, no, it's not like that. You can only do it as if they're actually there, you know. And, yeah, that filled me with a sense, well, both of their fragility, but, you know, I think fragility and appreciation, they go together, don't they? It's when you realise how fragile things are, you can really appreciate them. And I really resolved to be more active, especially in my community, than I had been previously, to put much more energy into my relationships and even the physical environment. I started to kind of quite took to painting and cleaning and stuff like that, which I never had before, but it was out of all, I want these to last, you know. And so when I moved back to the London Buddhist Centre, in a way I was quite lucky in that there was a sort of choice of places I could work. I could have gone probably back to the Wild Cherry or worked in the Evolution Shop. I didn't really, in a way I was quite open to doing whatever seemed the most useful thing to do. And as it happened, the role of Mitra convener was also available at that time, and I was kind of convinced that would probably be the best thing, and then the way I could support people in the businesses, you know, especially the women's businesses, from that position of being Mitra convener. So that's what I've been doing over the last 2.5 years. So I wanted to spend the next little while just talking about, just my appreciation, this newfound appreciation of what's been created around the London Buddhist Centre. I mean, not that, you know, it has been created around other centres there, although I think around the London Buddhist Centre we've got something unique in this Buddhist village of a number of things in close proximity. And I thought I'd put it under the heading to go with the seminar of Transforming Self and Transforming World. So these are just some of the things I've appreciated under the heading of Transforming Self. They're not really in a particular order. So I think that being able to work in team-based right livelihood for most of my working life, the first thing that it's done for me is enable me to live free from financial worry. I really feel very glad to be free of, well, the sort of oppression of having my worth measured by money. And that just feels like a great benefit. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. She had just been on retreat. She had an amazing retreat. She was describing how she'd been on these higher meditative states and so on. But it was interesting because back home, back at work, she was in a real wrangle because the bosses were cutting the wages. It didn't even seem to be that she was annoyed because she'd be short of money. It was more like she thought, you know, that she wasn't being treated fairly. You know, that whole thing of like her, you know, they were cutting her wages but not so-and-so's, and, you know, it wasn't fair, you know. So it was quite interesting that, you know, she'd had this retreat experience, but then she was back in this world of all that comparison. I remember, yes, because I was, and I'll say this other bit first from that Bhante said, which I think for me ties in with this. He says, so much of our effort spent trying to resist society's oppressive, coercive, crushing influence and preserve for ourselves a little bit of space within which we can grow and develop. In an ideal society, we will not have to resist all the time or be on the defensive all the time. And the greater part of our energy will be available for our own individual development in a free association with other like-minded people. And I must say, I really feel grateful for that in the financial arena. Just seeing the struggles of some of my friends. I was chatting to someone else who lives in my community the other morning, and she's just started working in a team-based right livelihood business. She, before that, she worked in banking, and she, I don't know how much she earned, but she said it was a good wage, so it was probably quite a bit. And she said, you know what, the amazing thing is, she said, money's not in the forefront of my mind anymore. And I thought that was very interesting, even though she had actually had much less. She just said, well, everything's looked after, you know, so it's not in the forefront of her mind. And my own experience, a couple of years ago, of this 3 weeks working for wages, and it wasn't an evolution shop, but because I was only there for 3 weeks, I was on the system of wages, and I just found it incredibly anxiety-making. The first thing was, it had to be decided, I think if you'd worked in an evolution shop before, you got £6.75 instead of £6.25. So I qualified for the higher amount, but I felt a bit bad about it, because I thought, but I've forgotten most of it, and these other people are only on £6.25. No, I genuinely did. It was really, I felt an awkwardness of I'm getting more than them, but they're actually better than me. And then, but then I was doing quite a bit of overtime, and people were saying, but how come she's doing that overtime, and we're not? But they weren't really saying it in a horrible way, but I could feel that tension. I thought, gosh, I'm not used to this, you know. I really wasn't used to it, because my whole life up until that point had been spent, well, you just, I suppose when I worked in the Cherry and the other evolution shop, you know, if work needed done, you just did it. You weren't kind of counting, oh, well, that's another £6.25 I have to get, or that's double time or something. I found that, I found it extremely unpleasant, actually. I found it very unpleasant to be in that arena of myself counting up, oh good, I've done an extra half hour, that means I get an extra few pounds, you know. Noticing that that produced a sort of acquisitiveness in myself, but also a strange and a sort of not open relationship with other people, because I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't tell them I'm doing this overtime. So, and it was unpleasant. So I was very, very glad when that, I was grateful for the opportunity to earn some money, I don't mean that, but I was glad when that was over, and at that point, that was when I thought, I really do hope I never have to be in that arena again. So I feel strangely happier with, I don't know, I find it easier not having any. I meant to bring it in my little bank statement. I got a little cat print out before I came so I could tell you how much I had in the bank. I think it was £34.50 or something. And I just thought, well, that's okay, you know. That's okay because I know my needs will be met. I sort of prefer not to have savings, which is just as well since I haven't got any. I find... I find it a cleaner way to live, sort of without having a nest egg. I find that people have been very generous to me, and that somehow that's easier to receive if I haven't got a secret little nest egg tucked away. I don't quite know how to put that into words, but anyway, I find it easier just knowing that my immediate needs will be met. But I did have one little story to tell you, which is a positive story about money, because there was actually a time I was concerned about money, and that was this time after the shop closed in Ireland I was telling you about. I was wondering, well, how can I stay here? I had decided I wanted to stay, especially to help women who wanted to get ordained. And I thought, well, how am I going to stay for the reasons I've said? I didn't have any income. And I said to my friend Pavara, I said, do you think I could pray to the Buddha for money? I said, do you think that would be all right? And he said, yeah, he said, I think it would. He said, it's not for you, it's for the benefit of other people, so I think that would be fine. So I said, okay then, I'll pray to the Buddha for money. So I went on retreat, and my visualization practice is Ratnasambhava, who happens to be the Buddha of wealth. So I thought, okay, I'm going to pray to Ratnasambhava for money so that I can stay in Ireland. So I was meditating the first day, and I prayed for money. And then the next day I was meditating, I prayed for money. And then that second night I had this dream, and I dreamt that I was organising a Buddhist festival, and that I had commissioned an order member, his name is Chintamani, to make this gigantic jewel. So there is a real order member called Chintamani, but Chintamani is also the name of the wish-fulfilling jewel that Ratnasambhava holds. So I dreamt of this order member, Chintamani. I'd asked him to construct this gigantic jewel, and we were discussing this together. And as we were discussing it in the dream, someone came rushing in and delivered me a letter. And as I opened the letter, all these diamonds and jewels and everything all came spilling out. And there was a note in the letter, and the letter said, the note was, "Oh, thank you for leading such and such a retreat. We're so grateful. This is a token of our thanks." Signed by somebody, and I looked at it and I thought, oh gosh, you know, I can't, that's lovely, but I can't even remember who these people are, you know, that have written, that I'm supposed to have led this retreat. So I felt a bit bad about that. Anyway, then I woke up, and when I woke up, I realized, okay, that's okay, I don't need to pray anymore. This is the answer. The answer is that even if you can't remember all the connections you've made, you have made all these connections, and so that will be okay. I can't really describe it, but I just knew that would be okay. And then people started giving me lots of money. And for a start on the retreat, they had a whip round and gave me a sum of money. But then, a few weeks later, I was on an order weekend, and some people came up to me, they're all excited. They said, "Come to the Evolution Shop in Cambridge, come and see our shop." And I sort of went along, and they said, "Oh, we've got something for you." And they gave me a cheque. It was for several thousand pounds. I said, "Oh, that was very nice." You know, they said, "Oh, yeah, we've decided to give you. We've decided to give you a donation." And so I was quite overwhelmed by that. And then on the same order weekend, I was sitting down. Someone else came up to me very excited, and they gave me an envelope, and I opened it. And there was a cheque for another few thousand. And I was saying, no, I've had the cheque. There was a, no, this is another one. And another team at Windhorse had also decided to pull some money and give me all this money. So anyway, I suddenly was presented with all this money, and it was enough then to stay in Ireland. So I don't often tell that story to people because it's a bit funny, isn't it, praying for money and everything, but I kind of want to tell in this context because it really increased my faith. You see, it's hard to describe because it's not that I expect people to give me money. You know, they might never again. It's not that I'm thinking, I've only got £34 in the bank, but that's okay because people are going to give me this. It's not that at all. It's more that I feel more and more confident that by putting my energy and commitment into relationships and creating Sangha, that's more and more what I want to do. That's all I need to bother about. That's the feeling. And it's not even that, it's almost, I mean, again, that sounds a bit fanciful, but it's like there's this sort of stream of energy in me, and that's just what it wants to do, and I just need to just let it. And it doesn't, that won't meet resistance. It's good, isn't it? Because if what you want to do is put energy into creating Sangha and relationships, that's not going to meet resistance. You know, I think I feel this very strongly. We need to have something to give ourselves to that won't stop us in that process. It's very painful to be stopped, isn't it? You're trying to give yourself if you're stopped in that. But the Dharma and the Sangha aren't going to stop you, so you can allow your energy to freely flow. So I thought I thought it was a rather lovely story of Ratnasambhava's blessing to share with you. So that's the first benefit. Others aren't so long as that. So I think another benefit, personal benefit, and again, all of you who've worked in any way with people who are also practicing will know what I mean by this, is just that constant reflecting back by people who share the same values as ourselves. I mean, I've got hundreds of examples of that. So many. I don't even know what to choose in terms of examples of that. But I find that so valuable. My friend Maitreya Bandhu, he said, "Well, we act like an external conscience for each other," and I really like that. And the things we we often can't see ourselves, our friend can see it for us. As a matter of fact, I will share one he said to me the other day. We were in a meeting together. It was going to be quite a tough business meeting. And I thought, okay, I know how I'll prepare for this. I'll do a Metta Bhavana in the morning, and I'll put every single person who's going to be in the meeting in the Metta Bhavana. So I did that. And then I was in the meeting, and at the first tea break, I said to my Tribhanda, I said, you know, my Tribhanda, I did a Metta Bhavana for all of us this morning. He said, yeah, I know. I said, oh, do you? I said, can you tell? And he said, well, it's not that. He said, I know how irritable you get, and I know you'd have tried to do something to work against it. So I didn't quite get the phrase that I expected. I said, but, you know, have I been doing all right? He said, once or twice I've seen you go a bit funny. And I said, oh, what do I look like then? He said, well, you do this little face like, And he said, your glasses seem to get smaller. He said, my glasses. So anyway, it's great having friends like this, isn't it? These external consciousnesses. The reflecting back, as I'm sure we know, just a sort of human way to work. I was again, many, many examples of that. The other day, I work quite closely with my friend Hilary, who runs Jambala, the second-hand bookshop, and also another order member called Sangadasa. He was on the management team. He was leaving. And so instead of our business meeting, and again, those of you in Windhorst and so on will be familiar with this, we just did a lovely ritual rejoicing in each other's merits and so on, particularly in his merits. And I just thought, oh, how lucky to be in a job where this is part of the work, you know, where this is part of the work, to give each other a good send-off. Just really reminds me, you know, sometimes I get caught up into, oh, there's so much work to do, but just to come back to that human element. And then just, we've just been able to practice in all of my life. That's the fourth benefit I've had. And, you know, again, that's something Bhante's emphasised again and again, that as a practitioner, we practice in every aspect of our lives. You know, his vision of the new society, where our work life, home life, and our social life, for want of a better word, can all be explicitly Buddhist, you know, really makes that possible. You know, again, I was thinking of this friend I was telling you about who came back from her retreat into trouble at work. You know, even though she works for a charity, that doesn't support her meditation practice. It doesn't share her values. I just realising that, you know, for all its ups and downs and faults and failings, just to be in a place where there is that potential, at least for one's whole Buddhist life. Yeah, for one's life to be a fully Buddhist life. So that was the fourth thing. I think the fifth thing, though, is the biggest thing of all, which is what it's given me, being able to work in this way as something, something to serve, something that's bigger than me and something that I totally believe in. As Subhuti was recently saying, well, recently sort of asking or challenging, he was saying, well, how can insight arise unless we're engaged in selfless service? We need a larger context. And there's a lovely thing that Vasantra wrote in this old booklet. I think it might have gone out of print. It puts this very poetically. He says, we need an ideal because without one, there's no possibility of involving all our energies in our spiritual development. So we're more than our conscious mind, but it's as if we've only got this tiny bit of our energies available to them, while the rest lie dormant. And then he says, perhaps the reason they lie dormant is that there is no cause to interest them. It's as if we live on the surface of life, while in caves deep underground, the kings and queens of our energies, the magicians and dancers, the heroes and sages remain quietly aloof, unable to raise any interest in our desire to become a junior manager, to live happily ever after with a librarian from Surbiton, or to captain the pub's darts team. Even our goals of becoming more relaxed or finding a bit of peace of mind do not excite them. But if we aspire to reach these heights, then all of a sudden, in those caverns far below, ageless heroes will start up once more at the sound of distant trumpets and reach for their unfailing weapons, and goddesses will weave afresh the old spells which protect the daring. So I really love that, what that conjures up. And Banshee's original vision for the London Buddhist Centre was that it was an earthly reflection of the Buddha Amitabha's pure land, Sukhavati. There's a community at the LBC called Sukhavati, but really the whole complex that I've described, the businesses and the communities, that's the vision of Sukhavati. So a pure land, somewhere where everything conduces to spiritual practice, to the study and the practice of the Dharma. And when he opened the London Buddhist Centre in 1979, Banti said, he said, Sukhavati is not just another Buddhist centre, however big. Sukhavati will, I hope, serve a more radical and more revolutionary function than just giving people their meditational vitamins so they can stagger along the path of worldliness for a few more days or weeks. Sukhavati is intended to be the nucleus of a new society, a society that makes it easier for people to develop as human beings. So living in a situation which is conducive to one's development as a human being, i.e. to one's spiritual development, a situation where one can go on growing indefinitely, Banti says, is, I can assure you, a very rare opportunity indeed. It's an opportunity that didn't exist in Britain before the starting of the WBO and FWBO, and which one seldom encounters even in the Buddhist East. And then 30 years later, Banti came again to the London Buddhist Centre and gave an interview, and he cited Robert Bloch, actually, which Ratna Ghosha quoted last night, but I'll just say what Robert Bloch said again. He wrote a book about British Buddhism in 2008, and he said that we're one of the three largest groups. In a way, he's quite critical of us, but even though he's critical of us, he says that no other British Buddhist tradition has created such a distinctive social organisation with its single-sex communities, right livelihood businesses, and Buddhist order, which is neither monastic nor lay. And Banti, in quoting this just a few months ago, says that as we alone have created such a society, it behoves us to do what we can to keep these in existence, because it's what we uniquely have to offer. And it's a vision that I feel that I'm more and more I feel I want to join in with this, which isn't easy. I mean, especially with the market forces of today, we've heard a bit about how difficult it is to keep Buddhist businesses going. So recently at London Buddhist Centre, we had to close Friends Organic because of financial reasons. That was a health food shop that had been going for 30 years, actually. But it was just losing so much money. It wasn't sustainable. And then the Wild Cherry restaurant, which had also been going a long, long time, over 25 years, very hard decision to close it. Well, in a way, it wasn't. In the end, it wasn't hard because it was just losing so much money, but hard to get to that point. I fought very hard to try and keep that business open. I personally tried to do everything that I could, and without really even knowing why, you know, I was in there trying to help them with their recipes and trying to help them in whatever way I could from my own experience. And other people were saying, you know, look, it's a bit much, I think it's gone, you know, no, I've got to just try a bit more. I think sometimes it's just like that, isn't it? You've just got to try your utmost. It's almost like, yeah, I couldn't quite live with myself if I didn't try as hard as I could. But anyway, that was a battle not won in that respect. I'm pleased to say we went out with a bang. It was hard. Hard for customers. There was even customers crying when the cherry closed. And I felt quite unsettled myself with the closing of that restaurant. I felt a bit low, a bit sort of brooding. Well, what's it all about? You know, what am I doing with my life? Should I really be the Mitra convener? Should I have worked in one of the businesses instead, and so on. But luckily, I went on retreat, and that's always good for reflecting about these things. And on retreat, I was reading a book by David Brazier called The New Buddhism. And in one of the sections, he talks about all the different ways enlightenment's described by all the different schools. And he says something quite provocative. He says, actually, it's not what enlightenment is, but what enlightenment's for that's the real question. He says, if we pursue enlightenment as an end in itself, the pursuit is meaningless. It's just chasing after experience. And that the only noble purpose that enlightenment can possibly serve is that of creating a pure land here and now in this world. And if our practice is conducive to this goal, then it's worthwhile. And if it's not, then it's not. They're quite a provocative statement. I found I resonated with that very much. And I thought, well, if I believe this, then I think this is the way that transforming self becomes transforming world, actually. And I think it takes me and us right back to Bhante's vision of the whole movement being a nucleus of a new society. In the same recent interview with Bhante, Maitreya Bandhu was asking him, was there any spiritual benefit of living in the city? A similar question to the Windhorse trading question of years before. The Keto Raja mentioned, and Bhante said, look, the urban centres are where you communicate the Dharma. He says, and that's the basis of everything. And he said, well, you can't communicate it into thin air. You need to communicate it to people. He seemed a bit surprised at the question. He was a bit like, well, what are you even asking me that for? Maitreya Bandhu said he said that to him. They were rehearsing the question, and Bhante was just saying, well, that's where the people are, Maitreya Bandhu said, well, that's where the people are. Well, what are you talking about? Of course, you've got to practice in the city. And I felt that's when I've got a bit of a glimpse more of Bhante's vision. I don't claim to know his whole vision, but I suddenly thought, that's what must concern Bhante, is that the Dharma as teaching survives as long as possible. And this is the means for it surviving. And I thought, I want to be part of that. So that's what I can put my energy behind, even though, in a sense, I don't know the way forward with our Buddhist businesses. We've got to overcome all these various challenges that Ratnagosha spelt out. Although, interestingly enough, Bhante said the biggest challenge always comes from within, the part of us that's resistant to change. So I hope I'm not going too over time. If I just read a little bit that Bhante says, he's quoted in this book, Sangharaksha, A New Voice. It's from a seminar, it doesn't say which one it is, about his motivation to change society. He says, reflecting on the evils of life in a more concrete socio-political sense doesn't incite me to emancipate myself from it at all. It incites me to try and create a viable alternative in the form of a whole movement, a whole new society, within which there will be the possibility of a more decent human life, leaving aside anything spiritual. I won't say it makes me feel disillusioned that things go on in society as they do. It just makes me feel angry, and therefore all the more determined to create a better alternative. My ultimate conclusion is that the alternative can be created only on the basis of definite spiritual values espoused by the individual and by individuals working together to create a whole new spiritual community and a new society beyond that. Those of us that do manage to live largely within the FWBO, at least we've got a happy, meaningful, creative life compared with the lives of a whole lot of other people outside. And this is why we want to expand it. We want it to become more available to more and more people because we see how rotten it is to live in the way that some people have to live. As individuals, they're not strong enough to change things by themselves. But if they came across an alternative like the FWBO, they'd be open to it and would benefit from it very greatly. So I feel very moved by that passage. It makes me think, it probably makes me think of many examples, but I think of a particular young man who's been coming to our centre for a year and a half or so. When he came to the centre, he worked as a doorman, a bouncer, down in the clubs in London. He doesn't give away too many details about that way of life, but he wears a huge scar on his neck that I think is indicative of the kind of life he's involved in, or was involved in, doing that work as a doorman. And just one of these incredibly, you can see it straight away, just so spiritually gifted young man, just intensely into meditation, intensely attracted to the Dharma, kind of got the Dharma. And he just said it was like two lives. You know, he'd come to the centre and then started going on retreat and do his meditation, and then go back to this world of fights and, I'm sure, bloodshed and trouble with the police and all sorts. And I just felt so glad that we were able to offer him a job. So we offered, first of all, he was offered a job in Friends Organic, and then when that closed, he got a job in the centre team. And I just, I feel very passionate about wishing that we had more jobs like that to offer people. I just feel there's so few, you know. He was lucky in a way to get that one. It didn't even mean entirely, probably wouldn't have been his first choice to work in an office, but at least there's something to offer him. I wish there was more. I wish we had a variety of businesses. So, yeah, but I feel very pleased about that, that we can offer that to people. In the Wild Cherry, by the time it closed, it was a mixture of people who were Buddhist and people who weren't Buddhist there. And many of the people, particularly the people who weren't Buddhist, actually, came and thanked me at the end. You know, just said, oh, thanks for giving me the chance to work there. One young man said, he said, oh, I learned so much. I said, what did you learn? And he said, well, I learned to tell people what to do. And I said, oh, do you mean you learned about leadership? He said, yeah, yeah, he said, and he looked so proud, you know. So, and I felt proud that we're able to offer people, as Bhante said, if not even a spiritual way of work, at least a more human way to work. The way people, some people have to work, really is rotten, actually. Finally, I wanted to end with a ray of hope, which is we just have, in spite of all the difficulties, we just have started a new business, Lama's Pajamas, at the London Buddhist Centre. Two people work there. I live with one of them, and it's lovely to see her come home glowing every evening, saying it's the best job she's ever had, how much she loves it, the work. And it's making some money, so that's good, and they can already support a third person. So, you know, it's early days of that new business. It's only going to support three people at most, and some volunteers. But I did feel excited. I thought, well, maybe, yeah, just at something new coming into being that maybe other centres could take up. So I'll finally end with some lines from a poem that Bhante wrote at the opening of the London Buddhist Centre, which is the dedication of the shrine, and it ends with these lines. O long may we uplift our song, bringing light to the blind, life to the dead. From this gold presence, day and night, long may there shine on all, undimmed the infinite light.